Discussions in Depth Psychology is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute.
Hello, everyone. I'm Bonnie Bright, and I'm really pleased to be here today with my guest, Dr. Lionel Corbett, whose name you may be familiar with, and particularly due to his really iconic work on psyche and the sacred, which, of course, is also the title of one of his books. And Lionel has written and lectured widely on spirituality in psychotherapy. So welcome, Lionel. Thanks so much for spending some time with me today.
It's nice to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you here. So as I mentioned, obviously you've done a lot of work on psyche and the sacred and the role of spirituality in psychotherapy, and also just in our lives in general, because this is something that can be considered religion, but of course you take it well beyond that. And so I'd also hope that we can discuss some of the differences between what you consider religion and spirituality in our conversation to come. So before we go further, though, I'd like to just read a very short bio for you so that everybody has some context for your background in case they are not familiar with you, and then we'll jump right into the conversation. Dr. Lionel Corbett trained in medicine and psychiatry in England and as a Jungian analyst at the C.G. Jung Institute of Chicago. And his primary interests are, as I mentioned, the religious function of the psyche, and especially the way in which personal religious experience is relevant to individual psychology, and the development of psychotherapy as a spiritual practice, and also the interface of Jungian psychology and contemporary psychoanalytic thought. And one thing that you may not be familiar with is that Lionel is currently offering some workshops on these topics, and so we'll spend some more time talking about some of the content of those workshops. And also, I'm hoping just really to be able to pick your brain a little bit, Lionel, so that our viewers and listeners can have some of this, the benefit of this wonderful content that you have spent a lot of your lifetime bringing to all of us. So maybe starting out with that topic, I'd like to talk first about what the sacred is, because this is something that doesn't always come up in the topic of psychology, particularly general psychology. Depth psychology is a bit different. Jungian psychology, of course, we know that Jung spent a lot of time discussing and thinking about what the sacred might be. So maybe you can share with us how you would define the sacred and how you feel that people experience the sacred.
Those are rather two very different questions. We can't define the sacred. We can talk about how we experience it. And I use Jung's criteria, and Jung uses the criteria of a German theologian called Otto, who talks about the experience of the sacred or the holy as something which is mysterious, tremendous, and fascinating. It has that tremendous emotional quality of something out of the ordinary, just beyond the everyday ego. The examples that are always given are things like Saul on the road to Damascus, who hears Jesus' voice saying, "Why do you persecute me?" And he sees a blinding light and is blind for 3 days. Or Moses at the burning bush, listening to the voice of God telling him to go down to Egypt to free the people, and so on. It's experiences of that quality which we call experiences of the sacred or the holy. But the important point that Jung makes that other people don't make is that, first of all, these are not experiences of the Judeo-Christian God in the transcendence sense, as if the divine is somehow in another realm. These are experiences of what Jung calls the objective psyche or the autonomous psyche. So that originates deeply in our own subjectivity. It's not in some transcendent realm. And the next important point is that experiences of this quality can happen to ordinary, everyday people at any time, and they may not take a traditional Judeo-Christian form. They may have that intense emotional quality of something extraordinary, dreadful, amazing, but they may be completely novel. They may have nothing to do with our expectations of the way the divine is supposed to manifest itself in the traditional sense. So dreams are a very important source of numinous experience. Visionary experiences, which are like waking dreams, are very important. Synchronistic events are an important source of numinous experience, and so on. So what Jung has done is he's broadened the number of ways in which numinous experience can appear to us. And that's what psyche and the sacred is all about. We're interested in how the sacred or the holy appears to the individual, which may be very unique and individual. It may have nothing to do with the way the traditions tell you it's supposed to appear.
Yeah, that's one thing that I am personally also very interested in is how does the sacred appear to us? For example, you just mentioned that it may look very different to individuals, and it also may look very different depending on a particular religion. Does it also look different historically, for example, versus how it looks to us as modern individuals?
Well, people have always had these kind of experiences, because the psyche has a kind of organic wish to connect with something beyond. Human beings have an innate, what I would refer to as a kind of innate organic spirituality. So we are primed to connect with that. And what's happened is that our religious traditions have tried to channel that kind of instinctive wish to connect with the sacred. They've tried to channel that wish into the rituals and sacraments and so on of one particular tradition, and said that that's the only valid way of approaching it. But in fact, it's not the only valid way. In fact, revelation is continuing all the time, because manifestations of the objective psyche are going on all the time. So we don't need to be dependent on the historical, I almost said hysterical, on the historical manifestations of the sacred. It's revealing itself all the time, if we know how to look.
If we know how to look, yeah. It's such a critical piece of it. So how do we know how to look?
Well, we look for the certain quality of experience. I would say to a person, instead of what they told you in Sunday school, in church, or in synagogue, or mosque, or whatever, when you were a child, how do you personally experience the sacred? Have you ever had an experience of tremendous mystery and fascination and awe and dread? For example, many people experience that in nature, in the natural world. There's a group of people who are natural nature mystics. They experience the divine in the wilderness, for example. Those people experience awe and beauty and majesty when they're out hiking. They shouldn't be sitting in a building reading a book about what happened to somebody else, what William James calls secondhand religion. And then there are people who experience the sacred in dreams, in very powerful, numinous imagery, which may have nothing to do with traditional manifestations of the sacred or the holy. So the question is, how does the individual get in touch with that? What's awesome or numinous or powerful for the individual?
Right. And I guess each one of us has that capacity to determine that for ourselves, particularly by paying attention to the signs, just as you were mentioning. Mm-hmm. Also, as you mentioned, by paying attention to dreams. So can you say more about dreams? Because you've done an extraordinary amount of work with dreams, and it's such a critical way that the psyche can actually come through to us if, again, we're paying attention to it.
Well, the idea is that there, according to Jung, there's an innate image of the divine in the psyche, which he calls the self. It's written in the English language literature with a capital S to distinguish it from the personal self, which is written with the lowercase s. And the self is the maker of dreams. There's a very ancient tradition, which unfortunately has faded, but in the early years, there was an ancient tradition of dreams sent by God, very important in the New Testament and in the Hebrew Bible as well. And the idea in Jung is that the self makes these dreams. And they arise, when they're numinous, they arise from the deepest level of the psyche, from the objective psyche or the transpersonal level of the psyche. It's also called the mythopoetic level, because you get imagery in the dream, say, of gods or goddesses that may be quite different than the way the divine is personified in the dreamer's personal religious tradition. So you may have grown up in, say, a Western Christian home, and you may have dream imagery that comes from an entirely different religious system, maybe from ancient Egypt or from the Hindu tradition. That's why the Jungians say you can't Christianize the unconscious. It'll produce imagery from any religious tradition. It's not unusual for Western people to dream of Hindu gods or goddesses, for example. And the difficulty is, if you're a fundamentalist, you're quite likely, if you have a fundamentalist minister, you're quite likely to be told that these are demonic. For example, a woman dreams of that she has an encounter with Jesus in the form of an old lady, like a grandmother. And her minister tells her that this clearly comes from the devil. It's intended to deceive her. But of course, from Jung's point of view, it's simply an allusion to the notion that the divine has these feminine aspects. It's got to be understood metaphorically, not literally. Mm-hmm. These are very important distinctions, because the traditions want to freeze the symbol. They want to literalize the symbol so that only one God image is the correct one. But in fact, the divine can manifest itself in innumerable ways. So that's why this approach to spirituality is not particularly popular among many traditional religionists.
Yes, well, that's a really interesting fact that you're pointing to, and that is that our religions have, obviously, over the course of hundreds, if not thousands of years, evolved into something that seems to be very fixed, with, you know, a right and a wrong aspect to them, and therefore judgments are made and there are consequences. It all plays out from there. Mm-hmm. So I've long tried to understand that process and to really try to feel into how it is that we seem to be so stuck on those religions. Like, what is it that religions are doing for us that, you know, fulfilling some kind of a need for us, I guess, and how has that evolved into that set and fixed of a structure for us?
Well, religion, Jung referred to religions as psychotherapeutic containers. And what he meant by that was that if you have questions about the problem of suffering, why is there suffering, why is there evil, how can a good God allow evil and suffering, and so on, these age-old questions, if you are what he calls contained in a tradition, then the tradition will give you all the answers you need, and it'll calm you down and assuage all your anxieties and help you give meaning and purpose to your life and reassure you about life after death, and so on. And in that sense, the tradition is that's what he means by a psychotherapeutic container. It answers all your questions and solves all the difficulties that you have. Of course, nowadays, the traditional answers are no longer satisfying. Increasing numbers of people simply don't believe the old stories. They just sound like platitudes nowadays, which is why many Jungians think that a new God image is emerging gradually alongside our existing religious traditions. And this time it's not going to be based on some kind of external teacher like Moses or a savior like Jesus, some kind of external redeemer figure. It's going to be based on our own sense of connection to the objective psyche, to the self, to the bigger self. And that can take any form.
Yes, our own sense of connection to it. So that brings us back to the kinds of felt experiences that we each have had. I suppose it depends in some part also on our openness to having those experiences. I know in my own life, when I've had some of what I would consider the most numinous and even sometimes very shocking or surprising experiences, they have awakened me in a certain way. They've woke me up to something that I did not understand or did not have the capacity to envision before. And I suppose also some of those are what we might call grace in some structures or in some belief systems. And I don't know if there is a way actually to create those kinds of numinous experiences, or if it's just a matter of being open to those and then hoping that they come along, because they are very transformational when they happen.
Yes. Well, we can't create them. They are acts of grace in the sense that they're just given. You can prepare for them with spiritual practices like prayer and meditation and pilgrimage. All the traditions have these spiritual practices with a different content, but the same form. And sometimes that will predispose to one of these experiences happening, but sometimes these experiences just erupt spontaneously for no obvious reason. They are more likely to occur when we're suffering intensely, because when we're suffering, it's as if the veil or the barrier between the ego, the everyday consciousness, and the transpersonal level of consciousness is thinner. And so material is a little more easy for material to emerge into consciousness when we're in intense pain or distress or depressed or suffering. So I think these kind of numinous experiences are more likely to occur when people are suffering, but they may erupt at any time and they may take a very surprising form. That they're often referred to by mainstream psychologists as anomalous experiences because they're so out of the ordinary. But that's because the Jung's notion of the importance of the numinous is not well known outside Jungian circles. So mainstream psychology doesn't quite know what to make of these experiences. But Jung's a very important point in the letter is that these experiences have a healing effect. What he means by that is that they usually address some suffering that the person is going through, or some developmental difficulty, maybe from childhood even, or a complex, or some difficulty that the person is having. The numinous experience is so emotionally powerful that it's often extremely helpful in those kind of situations.
Yes, and I've also heard these kinds of experiences referred to not only as numinous, which is a word that I particularly happen to like, but they're also considered transpersonal and transrational, meaning they reach beyond the individual of the person itself. But all this is making me really curious, Lionel, as to your own interest in this particular topic. It's something you've been working on for a long time. You've contributed a huge body of work to this particular topic. I'm curious if you can identify the origin of your own interest was in all of this.
Well, I grew up with a strong personal sense of connection to something larger that I could never articulate. And I simply found that all the existing religious traditions just didn't address what I was feeling. I guess I came across Jung with great relief, because Jungian psychology allows one to articulate these kind of experiences and realize that they are self-authenticating. You don't need reference to doctrine or dogma or an established tradition to realize that you've encountered something which is very real and very important. And that was a great help for me, because I simply couldn't get there from any of the existing religious traditions. The existing religious traditions have God images that just don't seem satisfying to many people. I think it's in this depth psychological approach, it's very important to develop one's own, develop one's own God images, but to be open to the God images that arise. And sometimes they're very surprising. Mm-hmm. So a friend of mine who was a Roman Catholic priest had a dream, an enormously numinous dream of the Venus of Willendorf. The Venus of Willendorf was one of the most ancient pagan goddess images that we know of. It's from old Europe, I think, I don't know, 10 or 20,000 years ago. And it was quite extraordinary for this man who had only grown up with Christian God images to suddenly experience an enormously numinous dream of a pagan goddess figure. But that's what's meant by the idea that you can't Christianize the unconscious. It was a message to him that the feminine aspects of the divine were an archetypal dominant in his psyche. Unless you pay attention to spontaneous dream imagery and spontaneously occurring numinous experiences, you are confined to just the traditional stereotypes. And numinous experiences break through those kind of stereotypes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that brings up another question, and that is, you mentioned earlier in this particular conversation that numinous experiences can be really awesome or awe-inspiring. I'm not sure exactly the word you used, but one word you did use was dreadful.
Yes, they can be quite terrifying. They're not always positive. We have to remember in this context that Jung has this controversial notion of what he calls the dark side of the self. In other words, very briefly, he had a critique of the Christian God image that it was too light. It's all loving and good and kind and benevolent. I think it's the first letter of John that says he is all light and in him there is no darkness. And Jung felt that they'd split off the dark side of the divine. They'd lodged it, they projected it into the devil or the Antichrist in order to keep a purely good, loving God image. But in fact, our experience is that the self has a dark side. If you think about events like, say, the Holocaust or Hiroshima, or these kind of really dreadful, huge, large-scale events, these are what he would call experiences of the dark side of the self. And certainly that can manifest itself in nightmarish forms. For example, a woman dreams that she's being chased by the head of her mother, just the severed head of her mother. But instead of hair, the head is covered in snakes. It was an image of the Gorgon or the Medusa from Greek mythology. And this was a nightmarish image, but it was very numinous at the same time. It was mysterious, tremendous, fascinating. So it meets these criteria of Jung and Otto, but it's an example of the dark side, the negative, the painful, difficult side. So in this emerging new God image that Jung is writing about, we have to take into account the fact that there's a light side. Certainly there's of course, a loving and benevolent side to it, but there's also this dark, terrifying aspect which causes suffering and evil. And that's a radically new idea, and it's antithetical to many of the religious notions of God, and many Christians reject it. So this is going to be an area of controversy.
Yes, well, obviously, I mean, it is hard sometimes for us to look at something and see the dark side of it, or even want to look. In our culture, I don't think that's really encouraged for us to be able to look at the dark side. In fact, most of us do everything that we can, as a general rule, to escape that or to avoid it or to numb ourselves, even anesthetize ourselves against anything that might be difficult or dark. So how do you begin to work with clients personally, clients or individuals who either are seeking to find out more about themselves, learn more about themselves, or maybe even seeking to deal with perhaps an experience of the numinous that they have not somehow been able to reconcile in some way?
Well, I look for the, that's a rather question with many parts to it.
Indeed.
Let's imagine, for example, the biblical Job who comes to therapy. He's just had I didn't want to talk about a specific person, but we can talk about a biblical character. He's just had a terrible disaster. He's lost all his children in a storm that blew his house down and killed his, I think he had, was it 7 or 10 children? I can't remember. But he had a lot of children. They were all killed. And then marauding bandits stole all his property, his flocks of sheep and goats. So suddenly from being an affluent, important man in his community, he's reduced to having almost nothing, and then his health is taken away from him. So that's a good example of a character who might come for psychotherapy because he's, or she of course, is suffering intensely. Now, in that case, what we have to understand is that there was a divine permission behind his suffering. And his suffering can be interpreted in a variety of ways. So the traditional theologians will see it as a kind of test of his faith, that it happened in order to point out to him that the ways of God are deeply mysterious and he can't really understand what's going on and so on. So, but from a depth psychological point of view, the way I would look at that kind of suffering is, what is the effect on the personality of the sufferer? I'm interested in the way that suffering transforms personality. And when I look at the story of Job, I see the story of a man who actually had quite a serious narcissistic character disorder. He was quite smug. He was quite spiritually asleep. He was full of himself, full of his own self-importance. And he had a very standard traditional God image. And as a result of this intense, severe suffering, he went through a radical transformation of his personality where he developed real empathy for poor people, for suffering people, because he became poor and suffered himself. So there was a huge transformation of his narcissistic character difficulties. And there was also very important, there was a radical transformation of his God image. He had the standard God image, which his friends tried to impose on him. The standard God image says, well, you must be suffering because you were sinful. You've done something wrong. Suffering is a punishment for sin. If you repent, everything will be all right. But he realized that that was a naive and overly simplistic account of why he was suffering, that there was something much more important than that. That's why when Jung wrote Answer to Job, he said that the answer to Job is this radical change in the canonical God image. Jung said that the answer to Job was the incarnation in Christ, because you had to have a change in the God image from the account of God in the Hebrew Bible into the new God image in Christ. I think there was also a transformation of Job's personal shadow, of his own narcissism, and a transformation of his, and then he had a numinous experience of the divine appearing to him in a whirlwind or a storm, which of course was exactly what caused his suffering. It's what killed his children. So here's an image of the divine appearing as a numinous encounter just in the medium which caused his intense. In other words, you have to look into the messages. That the suffering is a kind of an opening or a voice. If you look into the suffering, you will often have a numinous encounter. Mm-hmm. That's where it's located.
Yeah, the psyche, in a sense, is providing a mirror to us to be able to give us some kind of revelation about our own selves that we can't.
Or an opening, yes, yes.
An opening, yes. Yeah, I really like that.
Yes.
Well, I know that you've been offering, Lionel, recently a Psyche and the Sacred series of retreat style seminars. Can you talk a little bit about those and what you're offering at those so that,
yes.
I guess it's giving people a chance to explore their own spirituality through a depth lens.
That's what I'm hoping to do. The format we've used is a Friday night discussion or talk where I'll pick a topic like suffering or evil or say the relationship of personality and spirituality, or I've talked about issues like forgiveness and the psychology of spiritually important topics like forgiveness from a psychological point of view. So I've done that on Friday night for a couple of hours. And then on Saturday and Sunday, we get together in a group. Usually we limit the number of people to about 10. And I encourage people to bring in their own numinous experiences. The point being that people can have very powerful numinous experiences that are spiritually very important, but they don't realize what's happened to them. They don't realize that this is something which is a unique and personal expression of the sacred. They've got nowhere to go that where people will mirror that and reinforce and validate it. And that's really what I'm trying to unpack in these seminars.
Yes, and it's such powerful work. So I think it's really important that there be a container in which we can have these kinds of experiences where this is mirrored back to us. And it's not that easy, however, to create that kind of a container. So I assume that you're having to really focus a lot on just making sure that it feels like a safe place in which participants can actually be empowered to bring this kind of material forth, because it's not always easy, as we've been talking about.
No, it's not easy. And of course, you're right that the issue of safety and confidentiality is very, very important. But so far, fortunately, we've been brought together in ways that have felt very safe and very comfortable. And it looks like it's working. And I'm extremely dedicated to this because I want to study the emergence of this new God image, with the way it's appearing to people. And it's very individual and quite fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a service to those individuals who've had a powerful numinous experience and maybe haven't realized how important it is to them. And what the implications are to them.
Yeah, Such important work. Where then do you envision that this kind of community will go? I mean, do you have an idea of where it's going to put us in a year or 10 years for those individuals who are taking part in that?
Really, I'm just trying to be just guided by whatever the self produces. And so far, it seems to be taking an interest in this work. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where it's going to go.
So Lionel, I know as we began to come to a close here, this next question is kind of a big one, but maybe it will give us an opportunity to offer some contemplation for those of us who are really interested in this particular topic. And that is, I'm curious as to what you think the implications are of this notion of a dark side of God. We've heard about the Jungian, the shadow self, but if we substitute the word God in there and start looking at this as a notion of darkness in God, where does that leave us?
Yeah. Well, I think we have to take one short step back, which is to say that from a technical point of view, the God image in the psyche, we don't know what the relationship is between the God image in the psyche, the way we experience it, and some transcendent divinity that the traditions talk about. Mm-hmm. Now, for many of us, the God image in the psyche, and for Jung, is the nearest you can get to an experience of God. Okay, so essentially, we're talking about an experience of God. We don't know if that's the same as the transcendent God of the traditions. But from an experiential point of view, the divine seems to have a dark side. This is Jung's point. You do see it actually in the New Testament, in the book of Revelation, where you have these avenging angels and all that death and destruction. But mostly you don't see it. And you also do see it in the Hebrew Bible, where Isaiah says, I make evil, and Amos says the same thing, and Jeremiah say the same thing. But from the point of view of our experience, we experience the dark side of God in the form of suffering and evil, intense suffering and evil. And Jung's idea was that we shouldn't attribute that purely to humanity. If we do that, we're not acknowledging the full power of evil and suffering, that to give it its due, to give weight to evil and suffering, we have to realize that there's an element of the divine at the back of it. And this is a very frightening notion. It means that we have to find a way of coming to terms with it. And honestly, the only way I know we can deal with that is to deal with personal shadow material. The idea, very briefly, would be that the archetypal shadow, or the shadow of the self, incarnates a fragment of itself in the individual, so that the human shadow that we all have is a fragment of the archetypal shadow, and that by working on our personal shadow material, that can have a kind of redemptive effect or helpful effect on the archetypal shadow. And if all of us do that work, we are, as it were, influencing the dark side of the self. But it has to be done at the human level first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a rather radical idea.
It is a rather radical idea, and one that may be difficult for some people to swallow. But if you look at there are a number of myths, including the myth of Sophia, that explains how she fell from the heavens and left a spark of light in everything on earth, including each one of us. And so when you start to look at that balance between the dark and the light, I think it's very clear to me, at least, that when you start thinking about wholeness, we have all of those parts within ourselves. And the idea that we can each do our individual work and be able to contribute to the benefit and the well-being of the greater whole, I mean, talk about a calling. That right there seems to make meaning for me in life.
Yeah, and talking about falling from heaven, we have to remember the myth of Lucifer, who was cast out of heaven because of his hubris, his arrogance, his grandiosity. And that is, and grandiosity is one of the most important sources of evil on the planet. Arrogance and narcissistic inflation causes enormous damage. I won't say any more because, for obvious reasons.
Yeah. Well, I know that a lot of people who are seeing this will read into that their own personal experience, but I agree with you wholeheartedly. And you know, thank goodness for Jung's work and for your work and for depth psychology in general, because it does offer us so many ways to begin to look at this, so many perspectives that can be so valuable for each one of us to begin to work with whatever it is that we're confronting and dealing with in daily life. So really grateful for your work, Lionel. I just want to let everybody know that if you're interested in learning more about Lionel's work, you can find his new Psyche and the Sacred, a Contemplative Community website. That's at psycheandthesacred.org. So please look that up. There you can also find out about those small group retreats that Lionel is offering for personal spiritual experience based on depth psychology. And you can also read more of his work or find more links and resources there as well. So Lionel, thank you again so much for spending some time with me today. This has been so valuable.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Discussions in Depth Psychology is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute.